Today in Yeshiva, this is a program that I was willing to miss, but I'm not willing to miss Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaSimchat Eretz Yisrael. So my flight is Sinai, I can make it back tomorrow afternoon, right in time to Yom HaZikaron. So I was in South Africa a couple years ago for a gathering, a communal day of Torah. There, it's called in Swahili or some Afrikaan, the word indaba. It has indaba means gathering. That's the African word. So the Jews of South Africa put together what they called a Sinai Indaba, where everyone gathered to learn Torah. It was amazing. There were 3,000 people that came. You don't have that in New York, because everything in New York is splintered. You live in this community, you live in that community, you go to this school, and this and that. When you're in small communities, everyone has to pull together. You've got larger resources. So 3,000 people came. So the keynote part of that conference was a debate between myself. Thank you. A debate between myself and a correspondent of the Jerusalem Post. This correspondent's name is Jonathan Rosenblum. He writes a lot about the Haredim. By the way, Ellie, you remember Yaakov Katz? He's in Yeshiva with us. He's now the editor-in-chief of Jerusalem Post. So we have a little connections in Israel. The editor-in-chief of Jerusalem Post is a Kush alumni now. So anyone needs to advertise Jerusalem Post, you probably get a discount. So. Anyway, so... He's Jonathan Rosenblum. He's a correspondent. He writes about the Haredim and the Haredi world. So I was meant to present the Dati Lumi side of things, and he was meant to present the Haredi side of things and have a debate. So I think he spoke first. He's a little older than me. And he talked about how much he loves Dati Lumi, National Religious Hesder, serving the army, how great it is, how wonderful it is. And it was my turn to speak, and I said how great the Haredim are. They're learning Torah all day, and they're producing Svarim and Tzedakah and Chesed. At which point the moderator, who happened to be the chief rabbi of South Africa, is a good friend of mine. His son is actually in yeshiva. He's going to the army. He's a big chiddush in South Africa. In South Africa, just to let you know and give you a global sense of what it is to work on behalf of Am Yisrael, in South Africa there's a law that a South African citizen isn't allowed to serve in a foreign army. Because in the 90s, when apartheid fell apart, so they kicked out all the white officers to make room for African officers, just to equal out the balance sheet. So had all these white colonels and generals who couldn't be part of the army anymore, so they joined foreign mercenaries. They went to Bosnia to fight, they went to Croatia, they went to all places to fight. Then they came back to South Africa and they created bedlam. You don't want drunk generals running around your community. So they made a rule that South African citizens is illegal to serve in a foreign army. Which means that if you're from South Africa and you want to serve in cell, you get thrown in jail. So the Palestinians were very, very active in South Africa because South Africa is ground zero for anti-Israel sentiment because the ANC, the African National Congress, Mandela, were very close with PLO. They shared office space. So if they can just create moral equivalency between the Palestinians and the anti-apartheid, the entire world has already voted against apartheid. It's a done deal. So they can create this moral equivalency that everyone will be against Israel. In fact, 2 weeks ago, they just ceremoniously inaugurated a statue of Nelson Mandela in Ramallah. A beautiful bronze, it happens to be a nice statue, and with his fist raised towards Yerushalayim, and they're working very, very hard to create moral equivalency between the anti-apartheid movement, and you heard that. So South Africa is ground zero. We have Talmidim friends of mine, you never met them, Rabbi Kohn, the Krengel family, very, very chasha family in South Africa. They're working yom and v'layla to support Israel causes. So one of the things they have to work for is to try to maintain secrecy when South African boys, sometimes girls, serve in Tzal. There's a lot of South African kids who go to Tzal. So what the Palestinians want to do, they want to try to get their pictures, and then if they get the pictures, they can then call the police. And so we have a rule in yeshiva that we're not allowed to take pictures, or Facebook, whatever, any boys from South Africa who go to Tzal. It's totally confidential, because if the Palestinian forces in South Africa will get hold of it, they'll then tell the police, we'll then arrest them when they come home for Pesach, or they come home for a family visit. That's really, really a whole different ballgame. Just trying to take you out of Amsterdam Avenue. It's a lot going on, and each place has its own dynamics, its own challenges. So there I'm in South Africa, and Rabbi Goldstein, chief rabbi, turns to us and says, we didn't fly you to South Africa to tell us how much you love each other. Start fighting with each other. We want to hear the Haredim and the Dati Lumi going at each other. So I said, look, we're not going to do that. But he articulated the Haredi standpoint, what they believe in, and then it was my turn to articulate what we believe in. It wasn't one against the other. It wasn't arguing and defaming and castigating. It was, you present your position, we'll present our position. So his position was simple. In 1800, the entire Jewish world is more or less religious. more or less Orthodox. In 2016, how many people are classically Orthodox? 10%, 50%. If you really inflate the numbers, maybe you'll get to 20. What has replaced religion for most Jews? Nationalism, secular nationalism, Zionism. The belief in national pride, in country, in land, even if it's not religious, nationalism. Any ideology which supplants religion is paganism, is avodah zarah, is impure, it has to be discounted and dismissed. So that's the Haredi position, that's why Zionism is seen. It's a very good point. If you're honest with yourself, one of the legacies of Lichtenstein was, if you're honest, don't flinch, don't defraud yourself, don't delude yourself, face questions honestly. It's a good point. So then I articulated our response. That's what I want to share with you today. So you'll realize, Mitzvah Hashem on Thursday, when you say the following two psukim, you'll know why you're saying it. Hodu Adonai ki tov ki li olam chasdeu. Me'eis Hashem ha'isazos, hi niflaos b'inein. I'll tell you what that word niflaos means. And hopefully what you should think about, I'm sure you'll think about a lot of things, when you say the word niflaos. The 19th century witnessed the collapse of religion across the globe. This was the age of reason, the age of science, the Renaissance. Man had drew himself, lifted out of the muck of feudalism, the medieval morass of killing and murder and stagnancy. The world was alive with progress, technology, industrialization. And man looked at religion as hocus pocus, as bunk, not just bunk, but religion was the great culprit of human misery. All the wars, all the crusaders, all the abuse, all the darkness, was all because of organized religion. And organized religion was, as we would say, on the ropes. And it wasn't Jewish. Christianity was in crisis. Islam, formalized Islam, was in crisis. And what happened was, well, let me take a step over to the Jewish world. The Jewish world was suffering the same experience. Judaism was collapsing. This is the age of reform and conservative and Bundist and secular. And we glorify the yeshiva movement. And it really was glorious in terms of its energy and the energy that it provided the yeshiva world. And one of Rav Lichtenstein's things, I'm sorry to keep jumping over the fence, but it's really important that we make this day not just about Israel, but a man who changed Torah in Israel. A lot of people, a lot of your parents, knew Rav Lichtenstein, you studied with Rav Lichtenstein, lament the fact that he moved from America to Israel. Because if he would have been in America, he would have been the Rosh Hashiva of this institution. He was the appointed successor of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he, so to speak, bolted. So from an American standpoint, the American community suffered his departure. But he radically transformed the Hezder movement. I know I've met some of you this year. When I say Hezder, you think of five yeshivas, maybe. There were over 85 Hezder yeshivas. Now, Hezder coalesced in the early 70s in the wake and the euphoria of the Six-Day War. Hezder then was dominated by Talmidim of Rav Kook. Those are the people that were moving this process forward. Rav Lichtenstein, by moving to Israel, infused the Lithuanian model, the Brisker model, the old-style European model into the Hezder world. And if he wouldn't have moved, it wouldn't have happened. It took a person of his stature. So today, you've got two parts of the Dati Lumi world. These are the terms you'll come to hear in Israel. You'll hear the term, you may have heard it already, Kavnikim. Kavnikim are those people that are Dati Lumi who are more drawn to Rav Kook's ideology. Not that they're warring ideologies, but that's the dominant formative part of their Avodas Hashem. Have you heard of places like Har Hamor and Merkaz and Har Bracha and even some of the Hezder Yeshivos? And that's one. And we all live together, we're part of one community. We're saying their ideology, their Hashkafa. And then there's a group called Gushnikim, people that were influenced by the Hashkafa of the Gush and its derivatives, places like Yerucham, places like Kfar Batya, Rav Shurlo, I don't know if you've heard of Rav Yehuda Shurlo, his yeshiva, places like Malei Adumim to a degree, some of the Talmidim of yeshiva moved to Malei Adumim, the Eli Lifshitz, back in my day, Rabinovich was the Rosh Yeshiva Malei Adumim. He didn't learn in Gush, his son actually happened to learn with me in Gush, but it was that more European model, more Torah Mada, Rabbi Soloveitchik. So it dramatically changed the Torah world, Rav Lichtenstein. So the yeshiva movement is still alive in its incarnation in Israel, both in the classic Haredi model, but also in the Hezder model. And by and large, boys in this yeshiva are going to be attending Lithuanian-style Hezder yeshivas, so the Skush, Kerem Biavish, Levi Makoto, Malid. Those are the ones that are more draw that are more appealing and compelling to an American audience, because of Cook's ideology isn't as latent, it isn't as poignant in America as it is in Israel. But you'll meet these people on the buses and you'll sense that there's a very, very live, bustling Torah world that people meet. Anyway, but for everything the yeshiva world was, does anyone want to take a guess how many boys were in the great yeshivas altogether? If you calculate, if you tabulate it, Mir, Slobodka, Panovich, all the yeshivas together in the heyday, let's say 1920, the heyday. Anyone want to take a guess how many boys were in yeshiva? Don't be bashful. No?
I wouldn't even know what it is. Is that
1,000? Maybe 4. Maybe 4,000. There are 6,000 boys learning in Mir as we speak in Israel. Just to put into perspective. Said otherwise, listen carefully, for every boy who learned in yeshiva, there were at least 5, not who didn't learn in yeshiva, who became atheists. We were bleeding Jews. I'm not talking about, okay, I won't learn yeshiva, go become a doctor, or rise from modern Orthodox Jew. Bleeding agnosticism. European Jewry was in a total state of collapse. So this crumbling of religion wasn't limited to the Christian or Muslim world. It invaded the Jewish world. Now, what happened in the 19th century as religion collapsed? Well, you've heard the expression, nature abhors a vacuum. Well, not just does nature abhor a vacuum, but human experience abhors a vacuum. And when an ideology fades, that vacuum is created and other ideologies emerge to fill it. So for thousands of years, the ideology that dominated human identity was religion. When religion faded, the 19th century was the great age of ideologies. Which ideologies emerged in the 19th century? Right, well, democracy, obviously. What else alongside democracy? Democracy is really in the 18th century. But what's the 19th century ideology that actually competed with democracy? Marxism. Marxism, communism, and then other minor ideologies, utilitarianism, socialism, all forms of ideologies. But guys, what was the dominant ideology of the 19th century? Not religious, not commercial, not financial. What was the dominant ideology of the 19th century that spilled over to the 20th and created the Great War? Starts with an N.
Nationalism.
In 1600, you would introduce yourself, "Hi, my name is John. I'm a Protestant and I live in London. Hi, my name is Pierre. I'm a Catholic and I live in Paris." All of a sudden, in the 19th century, that sequence was inverted. All of a sudden, you introduce yourself, "Hi, I am a Frenchman, happens to be a Catholic. Hi, I'm an Englishman, happens to be a Protestant." And all of a sudden, human experiences and shift, and not just human experiences are shifting, boundaries are shifting. And the shifting of those seismic plates creates World War I, as you know. Redrawing lines, not along religion, but along nationalism. I'm sure you've studied, you've got teachers who have taught you this. Nationalism was a dominant ideology. So here you have the 19th century. Millions of Jews are slated for historical oblivion because they're falling off the grid religiously. And religion is no longer capturing human imagination. And they're basically on the verge of oblivion, of basically being excluded from Jewish destiny. So Kadosh Baruch Hu invoked something called Jewish nationalism to capture their attention and draw them back in and keep them involved in Jewish destiny. And you know what Hashem called Jewish nationalism? Zionism. Listen carefully. The ability to believe in land, people, and history, even if you're not drawn by ritual, study, and prayer. A consummate Jew has two mountains that he stands on. Har Sinai, and what's the other mountain? Har Moriah, not Har Sinai. Har Moriah. Har Sinai is a mountain of religion and ritual, mitzvot, aseres, and nevus. Har Moriah is a mountain of history. Hashem delivers historical challenge. Avraham, Gier, Gier, Zerach, Beretz, Lolahem, Avadum, Vino, Slam. You're going to walk through this world. You'll be a Jew. You'll be hated for being a Jew because you'll be challenging people. You'll be challenging them to moral high ground. You'll be challenging them to be monotheists. You'll be challenging them to be moral. You'll be challenging. People don't like to be challenged. We're hated because we're a moral alarm. Rav Amital used to tell the following story. There was a Rav Amital had a penchant for telling us stories. He was a great storyteller. There was a person named Mendeleev. Mendel and the shtetl, his job was to wake everyone up for slichas. Oh, shadajal, he woke people up for slichas. It's 5 a.m, comes and wakes them out of bed, pours water on them. They didn't have their Android app where they had to perform a math equation. Spraying water on them. And finally, at Rosh Hashanah time comes, and Mendel is exhausted because he spent the whole hour waking everyone up. So during slichas and Rosh Hashanah, he's dozing off and he's falling asleep. So everyone in the shul, while they see him sleeping, they start throwing things at him to wake him up. You know, Mendel, wake up, wake up. They start throwing things at him, tossing things at him. He says, why are you throwing things at me? Why are you throwing things at me? They say, Mendela, you didn't let us sleep the entire hour. The entire hour, you made sure we didn't fall asleep. You think we're going to let you fall asleep now? So Amitel told us, that's what's happening in Israel today. For thousands of years, we didn't let the world fall asleep. We challenged them to be monotheists. We challenged them to be moral. We won. We didn't let them sink into paganism. We didn't let them sink into barbarism. We stood for something. We created monotheism. We created Christianity. We created Islam. We created the belief in one God. We created moral sensitivity. We created Yetzias Mitzrayim. And now they're telling us, now that you come back to your land, now you want to go to sleep, we're not going to let you fall asleep so fast. We're going to throw things at you. Missiles. Very, very interesting idea. Because with a moral conscience. But Hashem knew that in history, there would come a time which Har Sinai would not be as persuasive and as compelling to some Jews. So Hashem pre-programmed in the Jewish heart the ability to identify with land, people, and history. Who was the first Zionist? It's a good question for the Zionist Club. Who was the first person to make Aliyah? But think carefully before you answer the question. Okay. That's what it seems to be if you don't look carefully. Who starts the journey from Aram Naharayim towards Eretz Yisrael? He starts to travel from Aram Naharayim, let's call it Iraq, more or less. And he sojourns in Haran, let's call it Lebanon, more or less. He dies in Haran, at least the way the Torah describes it, and then Avram continues the journey. Now, who was Terach? Avodah Zarah. And you said it 2 weeks ago. Me'olam Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu Terach Avi Avraham Maschil Beginus Messiah Meshavach. So the first person to feel Israel was an idol worshiper. And a salesman, a pusher, an idol pusher. That proves that Hashem creates the ability for Jewish identity through land, people, and history. I literally spoke about this 2 days ago in Portuguese. I don't know Portuguese in Brazil, so they're interpreting. But Teca, Aca, and Paca, forget the land, people. Don't want to say land, people, and history. Land, people, and history. So to me, secular Zionism is not a divine miscarriage. Secular nationalism is Hashem's way of rescuing millions of Jews from historical oblivion. And you've met those Jews. And people here have been to Israel. Everyone out? Okay. Remember the taxi cab driver who doesn't wear a yarmulke, doesn't put on tefillin, but knows Tanakh better than you do? Or the falafel salesman with a picture of the Baba Sali and the Baba Cherevi? They don't feel ritually Jewish, but they feel historically Jewish. They're proud Jews. Serve in the army, protect our country. Habibi, you know, Habibi, Jew. That's Hashem's Nisan Viniflos. That's Hashem's wondrous ability to rescue Jews, Jewish history, even at a time in which ritual and religion may not save them and may not rescue them. That's why you're going to Israel at some point in your life, because. And to me, this was a game changer when I came to Yeshiva. I grew up in a Haredi world. And to me, they only spoke about Har Sinai. And they didn't give me an apparatus for dealing with non-Frum Jews. I just didn't know what to make of them. I lived in Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, there were a lot of Syrians who lived there. Chalabi Syrians. Unfortunately, there's no longer a Chalab to speak about because it's been bombed to Kingdom Come. But I come from Chalab. And they weren't Shomer Shabbos in the classic sense. They would play sports and Shabbos in the streets and they drive in cars. For whatever reason, it's a long story. And all the Ashkenazi Jews that I lived with in Brooklyn, they didn't know how to, they said, oh, they're Chayos, they're all the Chayos, they're not Jewish. But they were Jewish. They were in Kippur. They were Jewish. They just, And then I came to Yeshiva and I realized, well, there's this other mountain. And that's Hashem intervening in history, because Hashem created this ancient echo, the ability to feel commitment to land, people, and history. Now, God forbid it should max out at that. You're all Baruch Hashem on the track for two mountains, the two-mountain track. To study Torah, daven, or mitzvahs, work on your midos. But I want to give you guys the yashar koach, because you're part of this club. And if I had one change to make, let's say I were principal of MTA for a day, or any other high school for that matter, it would be that part of Limud HaKodesh should be Zionism. Call it something different, Avos Haaretz, Jewish history, whatever. Because that's that mountain. That's how could you be from without realizing that part of your frumkeit? Because frumkeit doesn't max out with your tefillin. Notice I'm saying the word frumkeit. To me, it's not ideology, it's not hashkafa, it's frumkeit. In my pursuit to be as from as I can, to be as best in Ovid Hashem, I want to be committed to my people, and to my land, and to my history. And I want to embrace those who show that commitment to my people, my land, and history. Not as exemplars, because they don't encompass the total package, the total composite, but I simply want to celebrate and amplify and endorse and acknowledge that part of them, rather than seeing it as irrelevant at best or paganistic at worst. And let me tell you who the poster boy for this was. Listen carefully. Who taught me this lesson? How did I learn this lesson? Well, the real answer to that is Rav Amichai, who owned the Sichot. But you know when it really clicked for me? It clicked for me about 14 years ago. Has it been since Ilan Ramon, Zecharon Lebracha, was killed? Was it about 14 years? You guys can, what do they call when they fact check, you know, during the debates on Twitter? You can fact check about 14. Why am I saying Ilan Ramon, Zecharon Lebracha? This man never wore tefillin. So he didn't keep kashrus, or it's hard to not keep kashrus in Israel, but I'm sorry, he didn't keep asa b'chala. He didn't keep taras ha-mishpacha. He didn't keep mitzvahs. He didn't study in Rabbi Mendelssohn Shir. He didn't read Mesil Sisharim. He didn't daven with a minyan three times a day. Why am I saying Zecharon Lebracha? Because when he flew on that shuttle, he flew with an Israeli flag emblazoned on his arm. In 2002, when it was not popular to be affiliated with our people, it was a very, very hard time, similar to now, but in some ways worse. Tremendous wave of anti-Israel media bias. And he flew proud with that Israeli flag. And when he flew, everyone looked at me, he brought a Kiddush cup to Shamayim. He made Kiddush in Shamayim because he knew he flew on behalf of Jewish history. And when he flew, he demanded kosher food. He never didn't keep kosher, but he demanded that Nassau provide kosher food. Because he knew he was flying on behalf of Jewish history, about which he was so aware and so saying. He knew he was an emissary. He was a representative of not just the Jews of 2002, but Jews throughout history. And when he flew, he took a list of Holocaust survivors up with him. Just like Yom HaShoah. He took lists of Holocaust victims or survivors, and he flew with them symbolically because he flew on their behalf. And listen to what I'm about to tell you, carefully. And when he flew, for the first time in 3,000 years since Torah was delivered from Shemayim, because Torah's origins are in the seventh Rakia, far beyond human imagination, cosmic galactic realities I can't even begin to describe to you. The first time since Torah was delivered from Shemayim, Torah was returned to Shemayim. He took a sefer Torah with him on the flight. And just like it was delivered with fire, it was returned with fire. Mimino Eshdas Lama. Imagine that. And Ilan Ramon was a poster boy for the divine role of secular nationalism, of Zionism. Because if not for Zionism, it would not have been Ilan Ramon on that shuttle. Who would it have been? It would have been a man named Alan Robinson. He would have changed his name to make it sound more non-Jewish. And he would have lived in Houston. And he would have had a picture maybe of his ancient grandmother on the wall, but he would have no historical consciousness, no affiliation with our people, no Kiddush cup, no Holocaust survivor, no Sefer Torah. That's why I say Ilan Ramon Zecharon Lebracha. So if you ever doubt the importance of Zionism, and you ever wonder what its role in history is, now you know. Now you know. And those of you coming to Eretz Yisrael next year, Baruch Haba, you'll feel this, you'll sense this, you'll live with these people. It's hard to feel here because you don't have land in the visceral sense. And you don't have people in the national sense. You live in cantons, Highland Park and West Hempstead. You obviously have a sense, but you identify more as sectors and as compartments rather than a national identity where it's what a schus is to be in Israel. Yom HaZikaron to Noah. To me, it's like Yom Kippur. I feel after Yom HaZikaron like I feel after Yom Kippur. To sit and cry with 6 million people, 6 million Jews. I spend the entire Yom HaZikaron, aside from the time that I'm with the boys at the cemetery or whatever, I spend the entire Yom HaZikaron with my wife. The whole entire family gathers, we sit on the couch and we watch in Israel the minhag, so to speak, that when a soldier is killed in battle, they put out a little movie about that. You can even, I don't know if you teach, I don't know what your program of Yom HaZikaron, there's some of them that are in English. You can even get them, like the boys in Philadelphia was killed a couple of years ago. I don't know if you have the authority to do this, but again, if I were principal for a day of MTA, I would make an hour and watch one or two of these film clips. They're heartrending. You see the parents, they go to the grave, they tell the story. Through every war, you can get them every war. They're on Israel television around there. I imagine you probably go to YouTube and then probably find Sirtonei Zikaron, Salach Reish Tafiyur, or Sirtonei Zikaron. You can probably find them on YouTube. And if you can find one, I strongly recommend. And I feel Kedusha. I feel Kedusha that day because I'm commiserating with my people. I'm thrusting myself into the struggle of today to reclaim our land and reclaim our history. And I'm celebrating, so to speak, the inclusion of millions of Jews in that historical struggle, which to me is Yad Hashem. Not my Sassan Chas Hashem. And that's the word niflos. Niflos means a mystery, hard, a riddle, not clear. Pella. As I saw, many people don't get it. It's not obvious. It's easy to learn a block Gemara because it's rational. Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. It's easy to learn Shulchan Aruch because it's organized. Siman Aleph, Sif Aleph, how black are the tefillin? Sif Beis, how long are the tzitzit? Sif Gimel, how much matzah? It's quantified, it's rational, it's mapped. It's Jewish history is not ration. It's a neshama. It's realizing where we've come from, how far we've marched, what it means to be a Jew. See, I forgot who I interviewed this year. But I don't know if I asked this, but very often in an interview question, or an interview, I'll ask the following question. I'll say, close your eyes and tell me, okay, who are your favorite Jews or was? But has to be someone who wasn't religious. Tell me which Jew inspired you the most, you can be living or not, but it can't be religious. Because I want to see what type of Jew the boy is, because part of being firm as being a great Jew. My answer? In a heartbeat, Menachem Begin. I don't have to think a minute. He literally stepped out of Tanakh. If you ever hear him speak, right? Just literally like he just leapt off of the pages of Tanakh. Was he firm? He said, no, I'm somewhere in the middle. Just like came right out of Tanakh. I'm sure you guys all know Jews, which is great Jews. They just live their Judaism with such depth and such intensity and such pride and such commitment. They've lost our Sinai. Baruch Hashem, you have both. Think about that other. That's niflos. Me'es Hashem ha'isuzos. He niflos being angry. It doesn't look from. It's not as if the Rav was the prime minister and Rav Aaron was the minister of defense and the Chazon Ish was the Knesset. That would feel from. But HaKadosh Baruch was a little smarter than us. And he realized and he created this and he implanted this at the dawn of history. Land, people, and history. Let me tell you, one of my most challenging moments, we have to 107. One of my most challenging moments as a rabbi before this weekend. This weekend was very challenging. Speaking Portuguese was not easy. I didn't speak in Portuguese. I spoke in English and they translate, but it's hard. Like you have to stop in the middle and you lose your train of thought. And it's like, you know, you try to build drama and then you have to stop and whatever, it worked. My hardest time as a rabbi was, hardest answer, one of the hardest answers, was 2006. I was in Los Angeles speaking. And then they had Ask the Rabbi section. An hour question, Ask the Rabbi, Shabbos afternoon. It was, we were fighting in Gaza then. And the following story was going around, that the soldiers approached the house, and all of a sudden, mysteriously, a woman appeared in a turban, and told them, don't enter that house, soldiers. It's booby-trapped. It's rigged with a bomb. Don't enter the house. Then she mysteriously vanished into thin air. And then a few hours later, the soldiers were fighting in a different sector in Gaza, and the same mysterious turban lady shows up. Don't go into that house. It's a bomb. It's rigged. And then she vanishes into thin air. Don't go. Vanishes, vanishes, vanishes. Finally, the soldiers say, who are you? What's your name, turban lady? She says, I'm Rachel Imenu, and I'm helping you fight this war. I'm Rachel, who's come to fight alongside of the Chayalim. So I was asked the following question. It was in Los Angeles, just to give you a little context. They said, Rabbi, is this story true? Oh, no, what am I going to say? Is this story true? Is it really Rachel Imenu? So this is how I answered. I said, if you believe the story simply because soldiers told it, you're naive. Because there's an expression, even an atheist becomes a believer in a foxhole. Soldiers under the duress of war all of a sudden see things and feel things. Just because soldiers are telling a story. If you can't allow yourself to believe that it occurred, you're a skeptic. Because we don't just occupy the world of material and concrete palpable. We have a world that we believe in that's invisible, the world of spirit. There's a historical continuum. Your grandparents are in Shemayim now participating at some level in your experience. It's not just bones and skin. We occupy a world that the eye can't partake of. But more important than the facts of whether it did or didn't happen is the fact that this is the story the soldiers are telling. That, to me, is the most important fact. That our soldiers in Gaza know they're not fighting a war of geopolitical contest with the terrorists. They're fighting on behalf of Jewish history, and they're fighting side to side with Rachel Imenu. That, to me, is the most important takeaway. Because they're the Jews who have historical consciousness and are willing to throw themselves on a grenade because they're not fighting for themselves. They're fighting on behalf of Jewish history. They're fighting on behalf of Rachel Imenu. Perception is reality. That's the most important part here. Do you know how many pairs of tzitzis were ordered to the front during the Gaza war? About 60,000. Now keep in mind, you don't order tzitzis if you wear tzitzis. You have tzitzis. 60,000 Chiloni soldiers who don't wear tzitzis said, we want to wear tzitzis in Gaza. We need two bulletproof vests. The green one, the ceramic one, and the tzitzis. Because they had that sense. And that's the Yad Hashem. That's the handiwork of HaKadosh Baruch Hu operating. Trying to have this make sense to you so that when you celebrate, because it doesn't feel from. It doesn't feel similar to a Gemara. It doesn't feel similar. And that's why it's relegated to a club rather than part of the curriculum. It's not a club for me. This is my frumkeit. This is my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is my appreciation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know how proud I am to say Hodul Adonai Kitov Kili Olam Chasdo on Thursday? I want to miss it for the world. You know how proud I am to be in a generation where they're Jewish soldiers. Do you know what your grandparents would say if they saw a soldier walk into this room with an Israeli flag with his lapel? They would start crying now. They wouldn't stop crying until next Pesach. For thousands of years, soldiers were associated with terror. They would run into town and rape and pillage and murder and behead with impunity. The fright and the panic, the terror the soldiers incited in Jews. The Jewish soldiers. Jewish soldiers. You know what that means? From or not from? From or not from? I took my son. You met Noam, but I have an older son, David. I took him for his first day to he's in a yeshiva called Yerucham. How's the yeshiva? I took him. I was bawling like a baby. Bawling like a baby, thinking about what my grandparents in Shemayim are thinking. They're looking down at the first part of my family, three daughters, in the upper part of my lineup. But this is my first son. Officially joined the, and when you join a Hasidic yeshiva, you officially join the army. You're now a soldier. Of course, you only serve a year or two into your yeshiva experience, but officially, if you need to leave, you need to get permission from the army. You're now officially on the army's ledger. And now he's being inducted into the army. If you want, you can Facebook, they may have even showed you this. There's a beautiful little YouTube video about 2 or 3 years ago when the Gush boys went to the army in the summer. In Gush, we induct the boys in the summer. yeshivas have different schedule. They go in March, a year and a half into their Hesder cycle. In Rosh and Yerucham, they go in 2 years into the cycle. So we go in Tisha B'Av, after 2 years of Yeshiva, around Tisha B'Av. So we took the boys. The Rebbe's always go to take them, like to send them off. So we took them to the Lishkat Gius. It's called Bakum. We took them to the Lishkat Gius. Not Lishkat, but Bakum, where they're going. And we just started dancing with them, just singing songs, because this was a mitzvah, Simchas Mitzvah. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, 200 people joined the circle, and it looked like Simchas Torah. It mamish looked like Simchas Torah. They were singing and screaming and Israeli flags and dancing. So you can look for it. If not, if any of you want to face that, I'll try to find the link. And look at that on Yom HaZikaron. Even if you can't cry, because I'm going to cry like a baby Yom HaZikaron. But I feel tears of Tara, tears of people who are most inept, like Kiddush Hashem. That's also a good thing to watch on Yom HaZikaron to feel the spirit. So Baruch Hashem, we've got some boys who are coming to Eretz Yisrael next year. I think they're a pretty good yeshiva. They're coming to Eretz Yisrael next year, and you'll feel that. Other boys, a little bit younger, Baruch Hashem, when your time will come. Come to Eretz Yisrael. This is your film crane. In the next couple of days, you should treat it like a yantif. Wear a white shirt. Is there a yeshiva in those days? Okay. Would anyone be upset if they wore white shirts?
Especially in order to encourage boys to wear white and blue, they have to have
any clothes. Okay, I'm saying. Wear white, wear blue, say hello, gusto. Not much yantif. Feel proud. That's part of your film crane. Don't do it b'chashay b'tzina. Feel proud. This is part. Zayyal masal d'nai nagil v'nitzim chavol. Horula d'neki tov kili alam chazi. You're living in an age that boggles the imagination. Boggles the imagination, the age we're living in. And then think about me'is Hashem ha'isazos. Me'is Hashem ha'isazos. Hina v'los b'nino. This is their bonus. This is their bonus on powering our country. Powering Israel. Look at where we live. One state after another is in collapse. Look at the economies in Europe. One economy after another is collapsing. Here we are in the middle of nowhere with maniacs on every single boundary. Don't have oil yet. We're getting it. Well, Dr. Bush guy's lady, Michael Stein, you know, has discovered oil in the north. But we'll get it. We haven't had oil for 15 years. 52 different dialects intake. They just put out an index. Are the best places to raise your children in the world. It's like a multivariable index based on education, based on government grants, maternity leave, parks, freedom, whatever. Best place in this index to raise your kids is Austria. Who knew? Second best place, Finland. Third ranked, Sweden. Fourth, Israel. Could you imagine? The fourth best place, America is like 22nd. You walk into high school, and not MTA, but who knows, they walk into high school, and you know, who knows, they're going to come home alive. Fourth best place. Superpower. Military. Every time we fight a war, we discover a new technology. Every time we have a crisis, okay, now we know how to desalinate water. Okay, welcome, California. God will solve you. Oh, now we know, iron dump. Okay, welcome, America will solve. Oh, now we know how to detect tunnels. Okay. Hashem, have a great Yom Tov, everyone. Have a great, great, great Yom Atzmaut. Check out those videos, whether it's your own videos or your videos. It's a great resource. Shkoyach, everyone. Have a great, great Yom Tov.